It's 7 o'clock. Thursday Night Talk starts right now. And welcome to Thursday Night Talk here on KHSU. Tonight, Brenda Starr is our host. As always, we welcome your contributions. Give us a call at 826-4805, or if you're out of the area, at 800. Let me get back to you on that one. And we're also accepting text messages at 492-KHSU.
Good evening. Thanks, Michael. The 800 number 640-5911 if you're out of the area. If you're listening online, and if you're listening on the archive, sorry, show's over. Anyway, good evening. The promo, I think, stated a lot of what I want to do here tonight. In real time. In real time. I was watching a show, and Professor, I call him Eddie, Professor Eddie, is from Princeton University. And he said, we have to learn the real leap of the Me Too movement. And it's not to take down powerful men, but to really challenge and uproot from the core, from the root, patriarchy and sexism. And as men are also part of the Me Too movement, as survivors and supporters, part of the male population has a serious learning curve. Patriarchy and sexism has been around for millennium. There are many, many stories, and where we are today in real time is this incredible event that happened today. When I knew I had a show this week, I thought, what am I going to do? There is this scheduled Senate hearing. It was supposed to be Monday, so I thought, well, we would talk about what happened, and maybe by today we would know if he was still in or if he was out. Every day has seemed like a millennium. Every day has been full of raw nerves. So what I decided to do with Professor Eddie in my head, with the circumstances around me, and with being a consummate C-SPAN junkie, I have to admit, anybody who listens to this show, you know, I have always in my life taken politics too seriously, as my mother said, but it's been that way since I was about 7 years old. And I like to watch everything. I like to take in everything. I like to read everything. I went, while I was watching 8 hours today, I watched Fox News. I wanted to see what they were saying. I listened to everybody. And I have that kind of sponge mind to do that. It also makes me very raw right now and ready to just squeeze this sponge out and go to sleep. So the women that I chose to be on this show tonight came from my heart, my eyes, my experiences of watching and listening to them, of seeing what they have done in our community. They give our community so much. They have for decades. And they will probably continue. So I wanted their story. This is their cultural moment as well. And I will have them introduce themselves. We will be talking about the hearings. We will be talking about what people do. And we will be talking about what we can do in the future. So I'll start on my left here. Sue, would you like to start us out?
Okay, I'm Sue Hilton. And I don't know, I've been a feminist since I was in my 20s, I guess. And here and now I'm involved in Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and the Raging Grannies for Peace. And possibly the thing that's most relevant is that I've actually done monitors, the safety monitors of Take Back the Night for probably 20 years, as many years as they've had it here, which means that, among other things, I hear a lot of survivor stories.
Yeah. I'm Terry Wecky. Fairly recently retired from Humboldt State. I worked at the California Center for Rural Policy. And I guess more recently, an activist come to light in our community, having moved here 12 years ago. I helped to organize the first Women's March in Eureka with some women sitting around the table here. And so I have all this spare time in my retirement, and what do I find myself getting involved in? I feel like, if not me, who? And if I have the time, I'm going to stand up and say it, because I do have the time, and I want to speak on behalf of people who have the job, they can't be there, and so I feel like it's my duty to be able to do that, and an honor to do so.
I'm Julie. And because of your invitation to be here tonight, and because of what's going on right now, A lot of things are going through my mind, of course, and I might talk about some of them later. But one of the things, I am from here. I was born in Arcata. And I realize every now and then that I was really fortunate when I was born. I lived very near Redwood Park. I could go by myself to Redwood Park and play. So times have changed, and my life was not always that idyllic, but that was sort of a memory that I hold very dear, because it's not something parents would do now, is let their kids go to Redwood Park alone. And in high school, I was called Pollyanna, which I sort of was offended by. But more recently, people have called me a radical cheerleader. And I think there's been an evolution, and it's partly because of, you know, awareness and things that I'm seeing and hearing, and it's been going on for way many years. So I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, hey, young everyone. I'm Ketcha Risling Baldy. I'm a professor in the Native American Studies Department at Humboldt State. Also the executive director of a nonprofit called the Native Women's Collective. And the work that I do is as a community member. I'm Hoopa Yurik and Karuk, and I'm enrolled in the Hoopa Valley Tribe. And I work with young girls on adolescence and empowerment. But I also work with women just in general. I think as I've gotten older, it's become important for me to identify myself as a survivor of sexual assault and domestic violence, but also to sort of remind myself that I'm also a mother and a daughter and a friend and all of the other things as well. So I think the more that these stories come up, the more and more I think about my own daughter who is 11 and the way that the stories that she's hearing now are going to shape what she understands about her future as a woman, and the things that I think that she can do from an empowered place rather than a place of victimhood or sadness. So,
okay. And that's a very powerful place to be. You were talking about when we were chatting before the show started that you were 12 years old when Anita Hill testified on the Senate, and your daughter is 11 years old.
Yes, and it was very interesting today to think about that, that it was such a parallel to what I remember sitting with my mother watching Anita Hill testify, not understanding everything that was going on, but watching the impact that it had on her and the other women that she worked with. So going into work with her and listening to their conversations and the way that they worried about this cultural moment as not making a difference or not making an impact. And I remember when I was growing up, not kind of making excuses for my mother's feminism with people. I would sort of be like, well, she's like a feminist, but not like the bad kind, right? Like she's like a really good kind. And like, I couldn't see myself sort of embracing that until I got older. And my whole life, my mom, she never apologized for, you know, who she was and what she was doing. And I think that that really helped with this particular instance, because now I have a very, very powerful young woman in my life. That's my daughter. And when I was trying to talk to her about what was going on today, I said, well, do you have any questions? Is there anything that you're curious about? Because I'll answer anything. And she said, I watch the news. I know what's going on. And you know, I'm paying attention. And I thought, okay. And she's like, and we're talking about it, like me and my friends. And so I think that they feel like they can be empowered by the information that they're getting. I don't think that they're internalizing it the same way, but I felt a little bit like, geez, we've come to this place again, and it's the same situation, and it's also the same old dudes. I mean, they just haven't even changed in however many years. It's
more
the
wrinkles.
Same old dudes asking the same questions. And I think that women are getting smarter, and I also think that they're getting more. I think our files are getting full, and we're about to get to the point that it's like we don't need the same old guys asking us the same old questions.
Yeah, so too, you just jiggled my memory. My son was 11 years old when the hearings were, and I shared with you that he went to a therapeutic daycare center that I worked at. And we worked a lot on language stuff because most of those children there were abused and neglected sexually and physically. And so he learned those skills when he was younger. So I was texting him the other day about, oh, you know, hearings and everything. And all he could say was, same as it ever was, Mom, same as it ever was. And there, but there is a sense of what they see and how they process that of when they see it again, how they're reacting to it. And when we do have to, you talk about, you know, you've been a feminist for a long time. Just that word alone, what does that mean today? Are there young women on this campus that wouldn't identify with that? Or the word patriarchy, when I thought, oh, if I put that in the promo, you know, that's kind of a, oh, don't want to hear that. But let's just look at the simplicity of words and what they mean. Let's just start out with that. Patriarchy is a system of society or government in which the father or eldest male is head of the family and descent is traced through the male line. So that's a patriarchal system. A society or government in which men hold the power and women are largely excluded from it. A society or community organized on patriarchal lines. Greek for ruling father. Sexism, prejudice, stereotyping, discrimination, typically against women on the basis of sex. A synonym, chauvinism, gender prejudice, gender bias. So these are words that I don't think they're... They hold a lot in that container. They hold hundreds and thousands of years of stories and pain and screams. We know this as women. We feel that. So what are the visuals today? You talk about that. What the visuals of same old, here's on the Republican side. It's still, do you remember when you were little, you were 11, you were little. To me, what was so stunning about Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas at that point was Joe Biden in the middle, who I've really never forgiven for how everything was done there. Kennedy on one side, who had been, you know, there's Chappaquiddick, and then Strom Thurmond on the other side. That visual will never get out of my head. So talking about what does it look like today when we looked at that field, when we look at the Senate, what do we see?
I want to switch the visual just for a moment because
okay.
I didn't see very much today. I just saw a very little bit of her testimony. And what I saw were the faces of the two women behind her. And that was really the very painful part for me because they were reflecting, I thought, millions of women. Some, you know, I know many who have had these experiences. And these two women were back there with that same reflection for all of us to see in that moment. Now, I don't know what those guys were doing, but it was clear what was happening with them. It was not hidden. So it for me, that was a really powerful statement.
Well, if you had the sound off, you would just see white men in front again, except this time they got a white female prosecutor to ask their questions. And the part that I saw, she was very respectful. I think one thing that struck me that I thought was a little crack into that patriarchy is when Joe Biden has talked about his role, you know, 27 mm-hmm. years ago, he apologized and he, which was something that I didn't hear today from any. I heard people apologize for what they had gone through, both Christine Blasey Ford and also Brett Kavanaugh, and what their families had had to go through, as if they had no role in what was happening. So I think there are cracks happening now, and I think what's seeping out is anger. You know, there was the uproar after Trump said everything that he said, and he still got elected. And now there are facts that are known and are being contested. And basically, it seems like it's going to all boil down to a he said, she said. And we know how that typically goes.
Or all boil up.
Yes.
I visually, I think of it as a volcano. And there has been the rumblings and the lava has been in there. And there is this moment in time that we're talking about where will it boil up? Not over, but up. What do you think, Sue?
I don't know. I certainly hope so. But it's hard to see because, you know, at this moment, you know, this whole, the social media, that everything happens instantaneously. It feels like anything that happens so briefly and goes away. And it's hard to see how things get sustained and held and moved forward instead of just here it is and there it's gone and on to the next thing.
Well, it's women like you around this table that make people remember. That's what I think.
I also, the more that I have been thinking about it, I wonder if there's more coming, and my question became sort of, what is the process if there is a person who has been confirmed to the Supreme Court and then it comes out that there are actual ongoing crimes that he has committed?
They can be impeached.
Because one of the things that they were saying in the hearing was, if we don't do this right away, more people are going to come out. More people are going to have things that they're going to say about. Like, more people are going to have things they're going to accuse him of. And my thing was like, yeah, so we should pause because we need to wait and see if there's more people. But they're like, we got to do it really fast or more people will do it. So even they are a little bit like, there's going to be more. And I just think that that's how it's gone. There's always more. They don't stop. Like, the predatory behavior doesn't stop. The actions, right, don't stop. And so it will be interesting to see if they keep saying, we're going into a crisis. And I thought, we've been in a crisis, you know, for a while. It's just a matter of which crisis is going to finally make people be like, okay, like, this thing is not working. We have to do something completely different than what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And I keep telling people, I get more, I don't know what you call it, militant, I guess, or I'm getting more activist focused in terms of, I don't know if I can teach my daughter that there is a way for her to fix this system or even maneuver through it. I think I have to help her to understand that there's only a way to dismantle it. There's the whole thing is built on the enslavement of people. The whole thing is built on genocide. The whole thing is built on, you know, stealing land and resources. I don't know if you can fix that. If it's like if the bottom of the tower is all that, then the whole thing is like very shaky. And I think that's what we're seeing. We keep trying to fix it and then it keeps coming back. So what are we going to do? Like, we have to do something that says that we're not going to have history keep repeating itself.
And we have this enormous example at the top. Yes. Doing all of the things you've just listed, from stealing land, money, and all the things that he says about women and people with disabilities and people of different ethnicities. I mean, it is an endless list. I cannot think of anyone I know or have ever known in my life who would have such a list of offenses. And yet, somehow, he is still there. So we're waiting for the tipping point on Kavanaugh. It's really, he's one example of this, but we have the prime example, and I feel so discouraged. I have to be, I mean, I'm so glad to hear you talk, Kutcha, about how you can work with your daughter to find ways to dismantle this. I think I couldn't agree more, but I have to say, you know, I feel like I've spent a good part of my life working on these issues, and it's discouraging.
Well, I think of Mother Jones in those times, and others who came before us and spent their lifetime talking so we can move things forward. And that's the only hope besides this bracelet that I have, I think.
I want to mention that article that I read in the New York Times about they interviewed teenagers about the situation to hear what they were thinking. And mostly where they were talking to young girls, and the young girls said things that sounded just like things that I would have heard when I was in high school decades ago. They're still saying, we're dismissed. If we say anything, now someone will say, oh, they're just boys. They'll grow up. What were you doing? Why were you there? How were you dressed? That whole, you know, BS, which I'm not supposed to say those things on here. Okay.
Initials are okay.
BS, okay. So, but then at the end, they interviewed one young boy, and they asked him what he'd learned, and he said, well, I've actually learned that I need to be careful how I behave. I don't want it to show up in the future. And I thought, really? That's the lesson? Not about what's right, moral, respectful, decent, but I don't want this to show up on my resume or my Facebook or when I'm being vetted for a job in the future. Mm-hmm. And, oh, this is just fine. This is where we are.
Well, we're also at a place where statistics, when I used to work with survivors and women and children, it was 1 in 4 women, 1 in 7 men. It's now 1 in 3 women, 1 in 6 men. So it's not going down. Mm-hmm. So the necessity to dismantle is imperative. And that's what, just let me let our listeners know that you are listening to KHSU's Thursday Night Talk. I am your host tonight, Brenda Starr. And I have with me, my guests are Kutcha, Julie, Terry, and Sue. We're talking about today's historic Senate hearing and dismantling unconstructive...
dismantling the patriarchy.
Dismantling the patriarchy. And you can join our conversation by calling 826-4805, toll-free 800-640-5911. If you don't want to be on air tonight, if you want to remain anonymous, you can text us at 492-5478, and they can be read on air. We do welcome your calls. And that also, in those statistics, 16 to 19-year-old teen girls are 4 times more likely to be sexually assaulted. On campus here, campuses all over the country, we're not exempt from that. Doesn't matter if you're a liberal arts college, if you're a ag school, or if you're a financial school, it doesn't matter. As we learned today, it doesn't matter if you go to Yale, it doesn't matter what your school is, it's not a badge of exemption from bad behavior. The visuals, I'll tell you, I did watch every minute. And like I said, I jump back and forth. I like C-SPAN, although now with digital, I might watch another channel so I can see their expressions more clearly. I can see every line in their face. But remember, back in 91, I had my 13-inch Mitsubishi TV, and I saw everything, too. But and then I will go to see what the Fox commentators have to say, what maybe MSNBC has to say, and then maybe later on check out PBS, what reports there and stuff like that. But with my eyes and with my ears, very compelling testimony. I don't think anybody saw the second part here.
I watched the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. His attitude, his yelling, did it not remind you of Clarence Thomas? Because I loved it when one of the senators asked him. Now, I wrote copious notes, but you know what that means. I have to go by my memory. Somebody said, did you watch the hearings? Because they asked that to Clarence Thomas, too. And he says, of course I didn't watch the hearings. That's when he used his. It's a high-tech lynching line. And he didn't watch the hearings either. Now, as a director, as a, you know, an actor, all that stuff, I'm thinking, because you were prepping, because you said the same thing over and over again, just louder. Just louder, just louder and more indignant. The same thing over and over and over again. If it wasn't Bill Shein, I don't know who the heck wrote that for him. What was your take of that?
It was actually kind of interesting because my mom called me. She's traveling, and she said, "Oh, he's trying to have his Clarence Thomas moment, but he's not any good at it." So it's not coming off the same way. And I really thought of it as like a whiny little kid. I was like, "You guys are rewarding him for throwing a big fit." Mm-hmm. And he's just like throwing a fit right now about this is what's happening in my life. And that to me is a tell, because as somebody who has been through an like abusive situation, they do cry. They do cry after, or they beg you, or they tell you, you know what I mean? Like, there, it's not that there's that emotion is not there, that they are so like,
it's not remorse. It's not remorse.
It's sort of like
regret.
Some people, like, they're not sociopaths where they have no feelings. Like, they're more like psychopaths where it's everything's heightened all the time. And so I saw the tears as like, well, of course you're going to cry because you think that that erases violence. You think that that takes that away, right? Because you have some kind of emotion in response to what's going on. But it's actually not about anything but like yourself.
Yeah.
So I didn't, I mean, to me, I was totally turned off by it. And I was with my husband and I said, I think this is hard for me because my heart is beating really fast and I can't figure out why. And he was like, it's because it's so obvious what's happening right here. And he noticed little things because he's a lot better about really watching. And I couldn't really watch it. I would listen, but I was like, not, I don't want to look at this guy crying on TV about my life is so hard because I can't. One thing he said, I was like, oh, poor thing. He can't like do something anymore that he was going to do before or whatever. But he said, you'll notice when they ask him questions, if the question is about assaulting a woman, he smiles and then doesn't answer. That's like, no, I didn't do that. He goes, he has so many tells. And nobody's calling him out on these. Like, he goes, like, he'll smile a little bit and then he'll answer. Or he goes, watch him. And they ask some question where they were like, are you a this? And he nods yes. And then he goes, no. And he's like, there's so many tells that are happening in this room right now. And I finally was like, that's why they can't let the other guy testify. Because this guy has worked out all of his lies. And the other guy isn't let in to what all those lies are. So if he comes in, he's going to have a different story. So it was really interesting to watch all of that happen. And when my mom called, I finally was like, yeah, you're right. He's not any good at it. She was like, he's just bad. He's just not a good, like, in defense of himself. And then watching the women behind him was really interesting because I think it was his wife. And then there was like two blonde women and they were crying. They were just like crying.
Oh, his sister and his mother.
Yeah. And like, we're sad the whole time and just like so much emotion. But the wife, she didn't have that same emotion. So it was really interesting to watch the audience sort of behind him as he would get angry and then they would kind of shrink back a little bit. And then, so the whole thing was
hardly work to watch.
Well, that's why I love C-SPAN, because you watch, not only that, but they leave the mics open. So before or after, you can hear those little conversations that are going on in the background. Number one, he cried way too much. You know, he did cry too much. I know you're hurt. I know this is an awful process, whether you're guilty or not. Understandably so.
Crying?
There's no crying in baseball, and there's no crying on the Supreme Court. Did we see RBG cry? Plus, he also said he has done more for women than any other. I'm thinking, did you see RBG's documentary, or did you live through that? But also the temperament. Let's talk about the temperament. Is this the temperament of somebody who's so defensive, who seems so insecure at times, who has so many, as you said, Kutcher, so many tells? Is this somebody who you want in the Supreme Court? Let's set aside the issue that lying under oath to disqualify you from being a judge. Also, a point that you mentioned before, if he does admit to any of these things, it can be a criminal investigation now in the state of Maryland because there is no statute of limitation.
Well, I didn't see him, but I did hear about his crying. But I did want to watch her. And to me, I felt like, typical of many women, she was trying to keep a lid on it, I think, which is understandable. But when she was close to tears, it was always about the incident. And it was, say, one of the senators saying something, acknowledging what she had gone through. And that would make me cry, too. It sounds like his feminine side was really about outrage about what he's had to go through. That's what he's upset about.
That he has to feel like a woman.
Yeah, that he has to defend himself. That's where his outrage is coming from. I felt like it was interesting when they would ask about how she processed something. She went into her psychologist mode, and you could tell she did things where people have to go when they've had to bear a lot of pain and suffering. She could explain it as a psychologist would. But, I suppose at some point I'll be ready. I didn't want to watch him. I didn't think I could stomach it, actually. So
I saw this great thing on Twitter, though. Someone said, could you imagine if a woman went into a job interview, started crying, and then blaming other people for what was happening, and then talked about beer for like 20 minutes?
I like
and
beer.
And then was like, give me a job. Like, what would happen? because that's what happened. He like came in, he cried, he yelled, and then he talked about beer, and then he was like, I should have this job now.
Wait a minute. Today like, he talked about beer?
I like beer. I like beer. What kind of beer do you like, Senator? Okay. I like beer. We liked beer.
I'm sorry, Terry. I'm going to have to watch this. This just sounds like Saturday Night Live. You've got to be kidding me.
Well, Saturday Night Live is on this weekend, and there are some skits that I saw unraveling as we were watching.
No, he did say I like beer, like a lot.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Well, one of the things that I've been thinking about, because women take a lot of heat for a lot of things, but one of the things that she and others are criticized for is, how do you remember this, really? And I can say from my own personal experience and from talking to other women just in the last few days, this is something you do not forget. It is a crystal clear memory for me. And it's been years. Mm-hmm. But I remember exactly what the setting looked like, what clothes he wore, what the view was out the window. I remember every single detail. And every single time I drive by that spot to this day, I still remember that. And I think I'm a very resilient person. I think, you know, I've managed my life. I don't feel like I'm, you know, not able to work and not able to function and all that. But it's not going to leave me. And the women just in the last few days when this came up, everyone has, I don't think there has been an exception. Right. Everybody that I've, you know, I won't even say how I'm with them, because they're all doing interesting work in the community and they could be easily identified and it's their story. But they all have them. From starting at the age of like 5, 6, or 7, I just talked to a young woman yesterday. That I've just known for a couple of months. And her story is about a neighbor, same sort of situation where it was just never resolved. And it's not uncommon.
No, it's a freeze frame.
I think one thing that occurred to me, because I was writing about this just days ago, I was standing in the kitchen with two of my friends, and we were kind of talking about this coming up, and I looked around and realized that every single one of us in that kitchen had been sexually assaulted, and only one of us had ever reported. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's how common it is. Mm-hmm. Like, just I could stand in this kitchen, and every one of us has dealt with things in our own way, and I could see like how easily it would be for people to say, why didn't you all report? And each one of us would have a reason why we went about the way that we went about mm-hmm. having this discussion, or what that looked like for us. And so that moment really hit home for me in terms of, I think it's way more common than people can even imagine. Mm-hmm. The amount of assault that people experience, but also the response. And it's not just like it's like a physical response that happens in your life, mm-hmm. that you have to make this decision about what you're going to do and I don't think that necessarily reporting is always the best answer for everybody, and I don't fault people that don't. I don't think that means that they don't have as much of a claim to have a discussion about their assault. I don't think that we have a system that supports survivors to do that, to actually be able to heal and move forward.
I guess my observation just from these past few weeks is just how strong the patriarchy is in our government. Because look what has happened over the past year. Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby. I mean, it did take many women coming forward. But once that started happening, they're down. But I don't know what it's going to take for... I mean, look how easy it is still. With Trump still in office and Kavanaugh. I mean, I don't want to do any bets, and I know some people who are, but I'm not going to be shocked if he's confirmed. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it will take, but I guess one thought that I have, since Kutcher was talking about how we raise our daughters, it is about how we raise our sons.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
How young men are socialized and what those rites of passage are. You know, it's a little notch on the belt. I mean, I don't know when that ends, but there have to be men that involve themselves in changing that way of, this is what this is what it takes to be a man.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about your question about what's going to change it or what is changing it is, you know, they have this thing called the Consent Project on campus. And I have to say that I think it's an amazing idea, and I'm not sure if it works as well as it could work, but just the concept that, you know, you only have sex if it's absolutely clear that both people involved really want to do it. And it's just, it's an incredible concept that, you know, we certainly did not grow up with.
Mm-hmm. And I worked actually as a sex health educator for a while. And one of the things we really worked on with people is the idea of consent and consent being sexy. Sort of like people think that, I was always telling people, people think it would be really awkward to sort of have this conversation. But I was like, it actually is kind of a turn on if someone sits there and is like, do you like this? Is this working? Right? Like, how about this? It can get really like fun really fast. And yet we're never taught to even just have those conversations.
Yeah, there's
an idea that we're just supposed to fall into
right.
sexual activity. It's not supposed to be something that you think about or that you plan. There's supposed to be sort of like a mystery about it. And it was interesting to talk to young men who were in college about this, because they were like, well, you know, that just means that we're never going to do it because girls don't want to do it. And then you have to sort of like cajole, right? And I remember being in a room with one guy who I actually really liked. I mean, we would hang out, we would go places together. And in talking to him, he said, if a girl doesn't say no, that means yes. And after that, I was like, I was young, and so I didn't quite know what to say back. And after that, I couldn't see myself being around him. I sort of like avoided him for a number of weeks because it just made me so uncomfortable, that kind of feeling. But I've realized since then that a lot of people grow up with this idea,
right?
You know, that if she's not saying no, she's saying yes. And that's so dangerous. It's so dangerous to teach young men that they have to trick girls, or that they have to like manipulate girls,
or drug them, or get them drunk.
Like that there shouldn't be an empowerment to those kinds of relationships.
Well, I remember when I was teaching at the therapeutic daycare center, there was a group called Men Evolving Nonviolently, and there's always been men groups that have tried to take on this issue too. And I wonder, you know, if that ground is really fertile right now or not. We do have a caller, Marianne, from the North Coast.
Hi.
Hey, welcome to Thursday Night Talk.
Thank you very much.
Glad you can call.
I just wanted to comment. I really appreciate how you've been talking about all these things about non-consensual sex and consensual sex, but also in dealing with non-consensual sex and reporting, because I really have always admired and appreciated Anita Hill and how she changed the way we viewed sexual harassment. And she was in a war zone there, and she was really attacked, and so empowered and so strong and so eloquent as Dr. Ford has been today. And those are all real powerful images and strength building for all of us and our agency. And I also appreciate your mentioning people who it's not safe enough for them to report. Because I think, again, with the Me Too movement, it's a very empowering movement. But because there's so much judgment around survivors of sexual assault, I appreciate when you're inclusive about people who just can't go through the reporting process because it's not right for them. And we sometimes look at this issue as like, you got to do the right thing or the wrong thing. And that's not it at all. You got to do the safe thing and the healthy thing. And I just really appreciate your discussion about that, because I think that's really important for us as community members and for survivors to hear that over and over and over again.
Thank you, Marianne. Now, I wanted to talk, because we were using the word survivor, and then people also, you know, particularly, I noticed that the commonality of the senators were to talk about victims. Survivor versus victim. Now, I remember back in 1978. Now, I interviewed this woman, Sandy Butler, on Through the Eyes of Women, which you can find the archives on KHSU. Actually, she wrote a book, Mothers and Daughters and Parenting Older Children. But one of her first books that I read was called Conspiracy of Silence. And it's about the trauma of incest. And it was my first concept of survivor, calling someone a survivor rather than a victim. And we were talking before about language. And what does that mean now with the language? Now, when our youth are witnessing the culture, they're listening to survivors and abusers and accusers. What language are they using? And this was getting to what you were talking about with the youth.
And I think for me, that term accuser is so
loaded,
misleading and loaded, yes, because it presents like that person has a lot of power. And in our system, they have the least amount of power. They don't have any power, but it presents it like they do. And that can be very infuriating. And it can be a setup for survivors, I think, because they're not defined by somebody choosing to harm them and victimizing them. They're defined by how they're healing and moving forward. That's what defines them. And it's in our rape culture, they so often get defined by their victimization rather than themselves. And I think that's one of the harshest things that we do to survivors, and then, you know, adding in the victim blame.
I think what you're saying is so important. I'm really glad you called. It's really important for us to hear. I mean, there's just, as you say, there's many reasons for reporting and many reasons not to.
Exactly.
The whole spectrum.
Yes.
And for us not to judge that either way, you know, because I think so many of our loved ones, we get many calls from loved ones, and you can hear in their voices that they really care about this person, but they get hooked up on the right thing to do, you know, and I need to make this person make the right choice. And we have those conversations of what makes it the right choice. And a lot of people, you know, maybe they come from a privileged place and they're not engaged with the system a lot, and they're used to people, you know, if they report a crime, then something happens about it. Well, there are no guarantees in that at all. And especially like we're seeing in these hearings, you know, people walk away not believing people, even when they, I don't know how you could see someone like Dr. Ford or Anita Hill as being disingenuous or less than authentic in any way, you know. But people don't want to believe that the people that they hold in high esteem could be guilty of such heinous crimes.
I think we should talk a little more about this, because it's interesting to think what you're saying is like you're weighing, well, your own personal circumstances, for example, against the possibilities of the impact of this person continuing the behavior somewhere else with other people. And in this case, it might just be about just basic fundamental values, morality, capacity, decision-making, and so forth. It may not be an ongoing, you know, slamming yourself against somebody at a party or whatever. Or it could be. We don't know. But, I mean, especially now that you've told me he's talking about drinking beer, that's just going to, like, I'm sorry you told me that. Now I'm like, ugh, really? I mean, that is such a distraction. That is bizarre. Like an infomercial in the middle of this.
Well, it's called an excuse for behavior.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, for God's sake.
Alcohol and other drugs is always an excuse for bad behavior.
But anyway, to get back to what I think I was trying to say is that it gets pretty complicated when you think about, I mean, I think about my situation. I think I was probably protecting a family, children. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that I was thinking about other students in the future.
Right.
I was thinking about the family of this person. They were great people.
One of the interesting things after Bill Cosby was sentenced was one of the women who talked at the, you know, where the judge gets to hear people, said that they still believe that he would, if he was let out, he would still do it again. Which a lot of people, oh, he's blind and he's 81. It's like, oh, let's get out the records that show that that's a falsity. It might not be a high likelihood, but it's still a falsity. But that's, you know, that's the discounting and the dismissive part of what you're talking about. One of the things I found interesting is when I was watching Fox that Britt Hume said, the Republicans need to say, I believe she believes this. I think she's mistaken. I believe Judge Kavanaugh. That's a defensible position, and that's what you have to hope for. And there you are in a nutshell.
Well, they don't, you know, well, I mean, it's partly, of course, that they just want to hold on to power and they don't care how. But there's also this whole thing about how it's, nobody wants to face the basic weakness of the whole structure that we're built on. And so it's much easier to say this person who's complaining is wrong, is confused, is lying. And this person who's up on top, you know, you don't want to know that the people on top are as evil as they are, and that the pain is so built in, that destruction, hurting women, hurting people, is so built into the system. It's much easier to just hope it's going to be okay.
I think one of the most chilling parts of her testimony about what memories really stuck with her is when she talked about how they laughed as they were going down the stairs. I mean, that just says it all. I don't care if they were drunk, that they were young. It was like, it was nothing. And they knew they could get away with it. And, you know, maybe because obviously all of them came from a world of privilege. You could tell from how they talked about their upbringing. But even she, even as an adult, she did not tell her parents, because you're sort of protecting the structure that's there. And, of course, you're knowing what is going to happen, although she probably didn't know the extent of what was going to happen to her and her family.
I also wanted to say about the term survivor that I learned when I was sort of working with survivors of domestic violence, is part of it also is trying to speak to what's truly at stake, because there are a lot of women that don't survive. And so when you talk and you say, I am a survivor of, you are showing what is truly at stake. And that is that a lot of the time women don't survive domestic violence. They don't survive rape. They don't survive sexual assault. And we have a really big issue in this country with Native women not surviving sexual assault. And women of color don't survive sexual assault. And so you need to know what's at stake with women. It's and it is a life or death type situation. And she talked about that in her testimony. She talked about that moment where part of her really thought that he was going to kill her. And even if she was like, even if it was an accident, I thought this is it. Like, and that's what that situation is. When you are in that situation, they could kill you. And you have to know, like, people need to know that that's the level of what we're talking about. It's not innocent games of young people. It's, right? It's that they... I remember talking to somebody when I was in a situation, and I kept going back, and finally somebody said to me, you know, when we keep trying to get you to leave, it's not just because we want you to be safe, but because this only goes in the direction where eventually he kills you. And that's it. And so it doesn't get to the point where it's like, no. And they, like, you have to know what's at stake in these relationships. So I think we kind of forget that. We kind of forget that for her and for, like, a lot of us, that's what it was. It's that moment of, like, I could die in this situation.
Yeah, the statistics prove out that she will die by his hands. The percentage is getting higher and higher. And it's violent, too. It's a gun or something. And... that's, like we said, the statistics are going up. There was a moment where I thought, I mean, I didn't really think of it, but, you know, it was just that this is such a moment in time where Kavanaugh could have said, yes, I drank a lot. Yes, I did things that, well, you know, I don't remember. Yes, we joked about this. There was not even that in there.
No, right. No remorse, no acknowledgement, no sense that he was in any sense guilty or in any sense responsible for anything. Everything he did was fine, and he's just being picked on. And I was thinking a little bit, it's the same thing, you know, she kept everything all under control because women who are emotional aren't listened to. He gets to blow up because men who are emotional are listened to. And that's the patriarchy.
There we go. Ladies and gentlemen, we're done now.
No, we have to figure out how to fix it.
Well, speaking of...
Because I have this side of me that wants to take care of everybody, it's like I worry about my friend, my men friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, God, what a burden. I mean, I remember when the president was elected, I felt like, I mean, by that time he had insulted everybody, every single group possible. I mean, even including vets. I mean, he was insulting everyone. And then I thought, oh my God, he's a white man. He's supposed to be representing white men somehow. You know, I feel a responsibility as a woman. So now this guy is representing all these old white guys? I mean, what are they supposed to do with that? It seems like they should be really on a path along with us to make sure something changes because he's the representative.
Well, that's going to take election. That's going to take more. Well, look at 92. 92 was when Barbara Boxer and Pat Schroeder and they all walked over there and they demanded this, that, and the other. There were a handful. What, seven of them out of how many in the Congress? And the only women who were in the Senate got their jobs basically from their husbands dying. Well, maybe not Olympia Dukakis. And... And that changed, and that's what we're looking for. I think the hopefulness is to move that. How do you deconstruct institutions unless you go in there and you try to deconstruct them from the inside out? Before we go, though, because we don't have a lot of time, I did want to ask each of you, in your activist way, including this day and this information, this moment in our lives, to educate, inform, motivate the passionate groups that you work for. Could you talk a little bit about what you are doing to either hold people in that container or to get them to march or to get them to understand?
Well, this is not particularly about patriarchy except in the very large sense, but I have to say that one of the things I've been working on less than I would like to be, but I'm really excited about Measure K, and I really hope that Humboldt County can do that.
Sanctuary City.
Sanctuary County.
County.
I guess as a retired person, one of the things, so I wanted to share with Elizabeth Connor's group, the Power Lunch Humboldt, about what was happening. But of course, they meet on Thursdays, and they were doing some calling and campaigning for Katie Hill in the 25th District. So I have this quote from this opinion piece that was in The Guardian, and one activist said, voting is a form of harm reduction. And so I and a group of friends, we are going to take, I'm not very good about making phone calls like on campaign basis because I know if the caller ID, if I don't know them, I'm not going to pick up the phone. But I will do it in person. So we looked at the Swing Left website, and there are districts in blue California that we can flip. And it feels really good to be trying to make a difference that way because who knows what's going to happen with Mueller's investigation, but I'm not going to hold my breath on that. I just feel like I have to be doing something. And so today, you know, after less than 24 hours, because I saw where Women's March National was encouraging people to do this today at noon, I thought, that's easy. I'm just going to email a bunch of people, put it out on Facebook, show up if you can, wear black and make a statement. And I realized, who did I send that to? Women. What was I thinking of? Why didn't I send it to men? We did have a few men that stood there with us. And I thought, that's on me. I should have sent it out to everyone. I mean, because it needs to be broadened that.
We learn.
Well, I'm following people like you, Terry, and the Women's March was remarkable, and I know you've been traveling around the country and talking to women everywhere, and it's, like, great to watch that happening. I'm glad you retired. I think a big part of what I do and have done for a long time is I encourage women to do the things that they want to do and to help them see that they can get around barriers. I'm working on, there are incredible women running for office right now, working on those campaigns. And there's a metaphor I love that I probably practice almost on a daily basis, and that is spitting in the soup. It's that idea that if you put some information into a situation or ask a question, it's like if you spit in the soup, the spit's always there. There's nothing you can do to get the spit out of the soup. You can't heat it up, you can't freeze it, you can't add more vegetables. The spit will always be there. And I think that's part of what is important for us to do, is to just keep bringing up information, facts, what you're doing on the show, asking the questions, saying the obvious, even though it may feel silly or stupid, but it's to say the obvious. And then people have to eat it. I mean, then you just have to know it's there. And then the other thing that I do, I mentioned just before we started, is I play music every day. And that's what's really keeping, I think, my brain intact. It's been a pretty tough time, I think, with this presidency. And if I didn't have that time in my day where I was not thinking and reading that stuff, I probably would have lost it by now. So, music, art.
I think for me, I think I've stopped apologizing for my voice and just started to say what I think people need to hear out loud. I call it incepting. I say these big ideas that I'm like, people might think are kind of crazy, but I'm just sort of incepting their little brains so that later they're going to be like, I have this idea that for some reason has been knocking around in my head about what this could be, what this could look like. I tell students that we have been raised in a settler colonial culture that has never taught us to be able to imagine the world without patriarchy, to be able to imagine the world without colonization. And there's this great woman I heard speak who said, you know, everybody has an easier time imagining what they would do in a zombie apocalypse than they have imagining the end of capitalism. They can't do it because we've never been taught to do that. So how do we start to even just allow ourselves to imagine a world beyond patriarchy and what that looks like? And it's not so difficult when you look to Native peoples, because we lived in a world without patriarchy before colonialism, and a lot of people don't know that. But our government system now is based on the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, which a lot of people know as the Iroquois Confederacy. And what's interesting about that system is that Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, they all worked with the Haudenosaunee to put this system together. And they were like, you have three branches of government. That's a good idea. And you have representative bodies of government. We should also do that. And you have a president type figure. We should do that. And you have a Supreme Court. But in the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the Supreme Court was all women. And it was called the Women's Council. And women served for life. And they still have that system. And that's what was missing. So when people are like, you all claim this democracy system, but it doesn't work. Like, everybody hates Congress, right? What Native people are constantly saying is, yeah, because you left out the one thing that we said had to be there, and that was women. And when Native people came to the table, they brought women. And men would refuse to talk to them and refuse to acknowledge them. The Cherokee came to negotiate their treaty. They brought women. And they were like, women have to be here. And so I know that it's not beyond the realm of possibility what this could look like and what this could be, because it has been that way. And I always tell people, like, patriarchy and heteropatriarchy and settler colonialism doesn't make any sense. It's anti-intuitive. It actually is really a difficult system to live under, and we're all trying to make it work, but it actually doesn't make any logical sense. And when we start pushing back against it, I think that flood is going to make more sense. People are going to be like, wait, this actually makes more sense. It's easier to live this way. So I see, like, a really powerful future for that. And there are, like, 28 Native women running for office, I think, right now. And
that's marvelous.
So we are starting to sort of push back against this system.
And that's a wonderful way to end this show. Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, they asked, well, what do you think the, how many women should be on the Supreme Court? She said, 9. No, I-